Welcome back. Today we'll be discussing a few outsiders in classical music. I put outsiders in quotations because when researching this topic, one's definition of outsider completely determines who goes in this category. Also, I think that if I've heard of this person, then they aren't really an outsider anymore. Because let's face it, I don't think I could ever be accused of being avant-garde or cutting edge, even though I secretly want to so badly. I think the most renegade I've ever been is when I cut my hair short in high school and bought a pair of black pleather pants a few years ago.
Indeed. Well, so I obviously think outsider can mean a lot of different things. It's a really powerful idea because so many of us have felt like outsiders at some point in our life, even if it's not like a permanent state of being. Just speaking from a socialist perspective, if we're going to bring up high school, heaven forbid.
That's scary time.
I certainly identified myself as an outsider at that time in life. And in some ways, I still do, though I appear much more mainstream nowadays. But I think both of us would agree that our life trajectories are outside the norm.
Definitely. I think being a musician will just like always put you as an outsider. Because so few people do it, for mm-hmm. one, I think. When I meet non-musicians, on the train or whatever, or on the plane, and they ask me what I do, and I say, "Oh, I'm a musician." They're like, their reaction is always so, "Oh, like they just found this exotic bird or something," and it gets really tiring pretty quickly, actually. Because it's like, yeah, I know. You probably have never met anybody like me. And they're just so fascinated by it. And for some reason, I don't know why that bothers me, but it does. And then it's even worse when they're like, "Oh, you do that full time? Like, you can make a living off of that?" Mm-hmm. That's a nice little, salt in the wound.
Oh.
But yeah, you're right. I mean, socially, musicians just kind of are outsiders.
That's so funny because I think maybe I've developed tactics to deflect that kind of like "Oh, you're so fascinating." Like I just, I tell people I'm a teacher and then they ask what I teach and I'm like, "Oh, I'm a music teacher," which seems a lot easier and more digestible, and it kind of garners more sympathy, I think, too. especially if I don't tell them I'm a college professor.
As it should. Being a teacher is hard.
Yeah. Even a college professor's hard, just in different ways.
Yeah.
But, man, power to all the teachers out there fighting the good fight.
Absolutely. It takes a special person to truly enjoy teaching a class of fifth graders.
Mm-hmm. And be good at it.
And be good at it, yeah. That is not my calling, I have to say.
Well, anyway, back to outsider. So I was thinking for me, the true meaning of an outsider is somebody who is not afraid to march to the beat of their own drum, who's not afraid to do their own thing and does their own thing without letting concerns about the establishment or, money interfering with their purpose or what they hope to achieve. And so even though, all the people we're going to talk about today are in history textbooks.
Right.
I think that they can still qualify as outsiders in some respects because of that quality of just really, pioneering something and not giving a damn about what anyone else thought. Or giving a damn but doing it anyways, I guess.
Right, yeah. That's probably a key component of it. I was thinking today, well, maybe I should bring this up later, but I was thinking about my friend Zuza, who is just a very interesting character. And I remember when we were both DMA students together that she did, you know, she put on a recital, and she's a new music specialist, I would say. And she actually wrote a couple of pieces, mm-hmm. and they were, you know, very improvisatory. And part of her recital also included these pictures, these paintings that she had done of, like, teddy bears or something. I can't quite remember. It was, there was, like, one I remember being a little silly. Like, it was a picture of a bear, and she named it Barley Bear. And it was very cute. And she's very artistic. And she just had all of her paintings up on the stage. And they weren't all of bears. I mean, it was just a variety of things. And, like, later, afterwards, Bob Morris, the composer, mentioned something to her about it, how he didn't like that. He didn't
because
like...
Because the visual art element detracted from the musical element, or...?
For him, I guess. Yeah. And I just thought that was, like, really a shame. Like, she was doing her own thing, because she always does her own thing, and he was, like, shaming her for it, you know? She was expressing herself in this recital and received this negative feedback, and I thought that was in poor taste on his part.
Yeah. I don't know. I like outsiders, and I think outsiders like me.
I confess I much prefer being on the fringe than in the middle of it all.
Well, there's nothing left in the middle, I think. The middle's boring. What are you going to do, write another dissertation on Beethoven? Play another Bach concert? Who cares?
I know, it is. I do sometimes laugh at the titles for dissertations, you know, because everything has to be so specialized now. They're just, mm-hmm. it seems like there are fewer and fewer topics available. But yeah, I think, well, and there's, what is the saying? You know, something like the fruit, the only way you're going to get to the fruit is by going out on the limb. You know, something like that. So you have to, like, take a risk in order for even the possibility of a reward. I mean, there's safety, right, in being an insider, right? Mm-hmm. That's the appeal.
Yeah. Well, and it is a fine balance. That's something I've learned in my career, and I was lucky that I had really great guidance in this, of, like, how to balance. My advisor had this sort of, like, theory of wackiness versus normalness, and, like, you have to find this perfect mixture of wacky and normal in order to, like, succeed. And I think she helped me find something that falls in those lines, I hope.
Well, right.
I see people doing really wacky things in the academic music world, and they're really interesting, but they're not able to market themselves or get jobs because their topics and interests, research interests, are so far out there.
Right, and so then you come to the question of, well...
what's more important? Is it following this topic and remaining an outsider, or
without a job?
Without a job, which I know a lot of, like, I mean, it's really tough, because I think some people didn't receive as good feedback and support as I did. In fact, I know most people don't.
Right.
And so a lot of people are like, well, this interests me, so I'm going to do this topic. And then you devote 5 years of your life to it, only to find out that the establishment still won't accept, like, that as, you know, viable scholarly work, and then they're SOL, and then they're stuck either leaving the field completely or adjuncting at four different colleges.
Right, right. It's just so hard to get. Like, you need that recognition. You need to be an insider to succeed, almost. It's pretty rare.
Well, you have to have this right balance of insider and outsider.
Right.
Until you get tenure, and then you can just be like, fuck it all.
I know.
I can't wait. I'm going to dye my hair pink when I get tenure, and I'm going to... I'm already thinking, like, if I get the tenure... if I get a tenure track position, I want to do at least, like, shave underneath my hair. But yeah, look nice. Out for a pink mohawk in about 5 to 10 years.
Nice. I look forward to that. Yeah, well, and then there are, thankfully, some pockets of people at an institution or some institutions that where that kind of outsiderness does not scare them.
Well, and is embraced. You know, something that I thought was really... I was really surprised just doing a little bit of reading for this podcast is Mills College.
Yes.
Out near you has been really supportive of a lot of the composers that came to my mind thinking of this topic.
Right, yeah.
I think Terry Riley, who I'm going to talk about later, worked there. I want to say Pauline Oliveros had some...
They're all connected in that, like, free improv...
Yeah.
Scene. Definitely.
I was like, wow, I should have gone there.
Yeah, it's a... the more I hear about it, like you, the more intriguing it is. I just interviewed an elderly woman who... She's a flutist, and she worked at the San Francisco Conservatory for a very long time. And she was, like, the first female... flutist in the Oakland Symphony back like in 1950 or something like that.
Very when it was cool,
you know. And
were you interviewing her for this podcast or for something else?
No, it was for an archive project for the conservatory.
Oh, nice.
And she studied at Mills back in like right after World War II. I think it was like the mid to late 40s when Darius Milhaud was there. And I asked this woman about what that was like, being a female and being in, you know, a composition class where there were obviously other men. And she said that even back then, it wasn't a big deal. Like, she felt like she was treated equally and that she was actually part of the Milhaud family. I think we'll see when we talk about this... or in our next episode, Women in Music, that we just don't hear about the women who were actually doing the work, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the problem. There's maybe those women were hidden, you know, in one way or another, not physically, but...
Mm-hmm. Hidden by the men who make the history textbooks for the most part.
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah. We just
I'm hard-pressed to think of a history textbook with a female author.
Wait, say that again?
I can't think of a music history textbook with a female author off the top of my head.
A music history one. Oh my gosh, it's been so long since I've studied music history.
Like a general education music history textbook written by a woman.
Yeah, that's totally possible. That's too bad.
I got my work cut out for me.
Yeah, new project for you.
God, it's the last thing I need.
Let's see, what do you want to talk about next?
Well, let's talk about like there's like different kinds of outsiders. It seems like that was something we were sort of interested in.
Sure.
So we have like... sort of like the self-taught composers or composers that were working outside of the institutional setting. Though, what do you mean by an autodidact?
That was from Sam.
Oh.
Does that mean self-taught?
Yeah, okay. Well, was Berlioz self-taught?
I think so. Autodidact means a self-taught person.
Well, I don't think I wouldn't say Berlioz. I guess, like, I don't know. I don't think of him as an outsider at all, personally.
He was definitely ridiculed, though.
Yeah, he was ridiculed.
Because he didn't fall... I think it was because he didn't know the rules of harmony. Like, he did not follow the rules of harmony.
Mm-hmm.
And was, you know, like, look at this guy. Like, he's so, like, stupid, right?
Well, I think, like, the... What's it? The sort of caricatures of him that I have seen have been, like, teasing or sort of making fun of the loudness and noisiness of his music, sort of the focus on orchestration instead of harmony and melody.
Huh.
Like, there's a really famous caricature from one of the French newspapers of, like, a very thin Berlioz and these music notes just, like, attacking him practically, I feel like.
Well, see, the one thing I remember about Berlioz is that he did not follow the rules of harmony.
He attended the conservatoire, and then he won the Prix de
Rome.
Oh,
I see. Here it is. Okay.
So if you attend the conservatoire and win the Prix de Rome, I don't know if you're an outsider.
He probably felt like one.
Yeah, that's true.
You know,
I think any composer probably feels like an outsider by the 19th century.
Yeah. After Beethoven.
Yeah.
Right. He's an interesting guy. Well, now that we cleared that up, shall we go on?
Sure.
So you have someone who's self-taught.
Mm-hmm. I have a self-taught composer.
Okay. Why don't you talk a little bit about him?
Well, I'm going to talk about Wagner because I like Wagner. And I think even though he's, you know, one of the most famous composers of the late 19th century, in a lot of ways he's an outsider who desperately wanted to be an insider, but also had sort of, you know, the Groucho Marx syndrome going on, where he's like, I wouldn't want to be a member of any club that would have me as a member, where he wants, by maintaining his kind of outsider status, he could also maintain that he was above others. But he was not a prodigy. He didn't really receive significant compositional training. There were issues regarding his parentage, especially it was very unclear if his father was one person or another person. And there's always this sort of, like, it's been suggested that there's this latent anxiety that his father was actually Jewish.
Right.
But he came from this theatrical family. And so he's very much immersed in the sort of production and consumption of arts and entertainment. And I think that is what really gave Wagner the kind of kernel early on, like this sort of seed that allowed him to become such an incredible composer. He wasn't a good pianist. He wasn't a good conductor. He's not really a good writer, even if you've ever tried to read some of his some of his essays.
Well, 19th century writing is just kind of little challenging anyways.
He's no Goethe, that's for sure.
I mean, to me,
early on, like in the 40s, 1840s, Wagner was really aligned with, like, these leftist Marxist politics, where he was a young rebel, and that's why he was exiled for, like, what, 20 years?
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then when he was, during that exile, he was in Paris and sort of slogging away as a copyist, and that's really, I think, what embittered him on Parisian culture and I'm opera sure, yeah. and French, especially French Semitism in general.
Would you say that he has been successful because, or that luck played a big part in his success?
Yes.
Because luck didn't definitely, he like
luck definitely
advertise in the paper for yeah. A sponsor, basically a patron?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. Wagner was pretty much screwed financially multiple times in his life, and he was very lucky to have first like the Waisendonks that provided him with a place to live and, you know, support and networking in Switzerland. And then, of course, obviously, King Ludwig of Bavaria later paying off all of Wagner's debts so that Wagner could actually return to Germany. And then basically sponsoring Wagner and going back to this kind of like patronage that wasn't a system that was at all common by the late 19th century. And paying Wagner to write music, and then eventually building Bayreuth for Wagner. This is the same king that built the Disneyland castle, the castle in Bavaria, Neuschwanstein, that Disneyland's Magic Kingdom castle is based on. So,
right. Huh.
But without that, I mean, yeah, I don't think we would know Wagner in the same way that we know him and understand him today.
Right. So an outsider may also be someone who is challenging conventions on purpose, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And so someone like John Cage would be that. Are you going to talk about John Cage or no? No,
we're going to talk about John Cage a lot because I think he's the ultimate outsider / insider / outsider. Obviously, John Cage, we've talked about him in other episodes where he's really, a lot of his works challenged Western musical conventions, challenge Western concepts of what music is, and what the performance of music entails, and is music an art form, I think is what he really gets at. I mean, but, you know, challenging conventions, we can take this back, you know, centuries, thinking about composers. And, you know, it's by challenging conventions that composers actually get remembered, I think.
Right. I mean, think about Beethoven, right? I mean, definitely.
Even Wagner. If Wagner hadn't written the Tristan and Isolde, like, totally changing the conventions of opera, I don't know. It would have been a different operatic world.
Yeah, that's for sure. And then we have someone who is operating outside the field because they are rejected or because they reject the field themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So you have written down Erik Satie.
Mm-hmm. So Satie was a French composer of the late 19th and early 20th century who he's sort of like a spearhead for an avant-gardism in France at the turn of the century in a lot of ways, rejecting the past and trying to break out of sort of the conventions. He's very much associated with sort of the popular dance musics of the day, the musical, like what was happening in sort of the Parisian, Parisian, sort of
Bohemian demi-monde society.
demi-monde, yeah.
Yeah.
And similar to this, I think Jacques Offenbach, who was working a little bit before Satie, but also a German-born French composer working in Paris and just churning out light operas. And I'm sure you all are familiar with his most famous piece, which is the Can-Can. But he wrote, you know, so many operas and was never really accepted as a serious composer worthy of analysis. It's only really been very recently that even music historians have allowed Offenbach to be a topic of analysis.
That's so funny.
It's still quite debatable unless it's Tales of Hoffman.
And we kind of touched a little bit on this, that composers who saw themselves as outsiders, mm-hmm. and the person I'm going to talk about later, Eun-Suk Chin, I'm going to talk about her in our next episode in Women in Music, but she's a woman composer of today, and she has called herself an outsider, which I think is kind of interesting.
Yeah. So, like, claim that title. Who is that? Do you want to...
Eun-Suk Chin, well, she's a Korean composer. She lives in Germany right now, and her music has been, successful in the world of new music, you know, by new music standards. And she's done a lot of, she's written a lot of concertos that have gotten noticed. But in some of the interviews that I've read with her, she identifies herself as an outsider, and because, I guess, let's see, there's this one quote she said about, she wrote an opera based on Alice in Wonderland, and she said that the German new music scene, the Berlin new music scene composers there were like horrified that she could write, that she wrote these like melodies. And basically she was saying they misunderstood me. They're not really getting it when they hear my music. They're not hearing the irony and the parody. And I can't remember right now. But her background, like she studied a little bit with Ligeti. But I don't know. For some reason, she just considers herself on the fringe.
A Korean-born female living and working in Germany, I can understand how she might feel like an outsider.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and she does mention, too, that she doesn't like to use... she doesn't like to have her music display Korean, Asian influences. She says, she says, that's too easy.
Yeah.
You know, like that, like people who do that are, it's just an easy way to get noticed, basically. It's a very interesting woman.
Cool.
So tune in for our next episode to learn more about her.
So I wanted composers that saw themselves as outsiders. Well, I think for me, I instantly thought of Chopin because, he is this Polish-born composer who was another exiled from his homeland because basically Russia invaded Poland and he couldn't go home. And he really made his name for himself working and living in Paris. So there was always, even though he was, of course, fluent in French, there was always this sort of like exoticism about Chopin and a kind of foreignness that demarcated him as an outsider. And I think another
was that like other people marking
other
him
people's
as an
responses
outsider?
To him. I think it has to do, there's an well, you know, he cultivated it in his musical compositions, mazurkas, the polonaises. Right. These are all like the musics of alluding to the traditional music of his homeland, but the main consumers of them were actually the Parisian upper classes.
Right.
Another composer that I think really we can characterize as an outsider is Charles Ives, the American composer from the first half of the 20th century.
I agree with that. When we talked about doing this episode, I think he was probably the first one first composer that I thought of.
Well, because he was someone who was immensely talented. he went to music school. He grew up in a musical family. His father was involved in the town band and the church music. I want to say he went to Yale for music degree, but he had a little hard time getting past. And then he eventually, he went to work as an advertiser for life insurance in New York City. And he didn't work in the field of the art world. He made his money in selling life
successful.
Insurance and composed as a hobby. And
so, away from, he wasn't even in the loop.
Yeah,
right?
He was totally outside the loop. But because of that, he was doing some experimental things with music that were groundbreaking. And even his works, his sort of dabbles in atonality are at the same time as Schoenberg, when Schoenberg's, on the other side of the Atlantic. So I think Charles Ives is one of the composers, one of the first major outsiders. And I think it's important to think about a lot of, in the 20th century, I feel like American composers have particularly embraced this notion of outsider, like Ives and like Cage in particular. So I wonder if there's some sort of allure of the outsider in the American psyche.
Pioneerism is built into our DNA.
Yeah.
Certainly, being geographically separated from the scene in the early 20th century is, you just don't even have the access to what is going on.
It's sort
on.
Of like an inferiority complex. Right. Again, kind of going back to the Wagner thing. This is this inferiority complex that you embrace, and you're I'm going to embrace being an outsider and excel at it and show you what I can do.
Right, yeah. But now, I don't know if that's true anymore for Americans. If there are still even national differences in composers.
Yeah, I think what you're saying, there are some composers, especially I've seen a lot of Chinese composers nowadays incorporating Chinese elements, or there's several Japanese composers incorporating Japanese elements. Is there a global musical language, or does one embrace or infuse some sort of hybridic musical language reflecting your nationality?
Right. I don't know. I think you could probably be whoever you want to be, more so now than before.
Yeah, I think there's a lot more freedom as sort of the disbursement of music and sort of the medium of disbursements become more and more relaxed and easier accessible.
Right. Well, and then just with the internet and technology, you are free to, getting your music out there onto some kind of platform is extremely easy now. It's accessible. Mm-hmm. You just need to put up a website and get people to play your music, record them, and then that's it. And so you feel, so you have a kind of outlet. If you look at these composers like we talked about at the beginning, at the top of the episode, where the composers that we've talked about, with the exception of maybe Eunsuk Chin, are all people that we can learn about in a textbook, which basically means that these once outsiders are now insiders. We have accepted them into our fold. And an outsider can become an insider.
Mm-hmm.
If they want to or not,
Yeah, they eventually don't have a choice.
Right.
Out of all of them, John Cage is still... It's funny, he's the one most held up as an outsider. But at the same time, I think he's the one that people most bristle at also, especially the conservative branch of music and music academia.
Because, like, philosophically, it's foreign.
Philosophically foreign. It's too... There's this weird anti-intellectualism in all fields, even music, that I don't understand, that seems to be taking root in America and elsewhere.
Yeah.
I'm not totally sure. I've never seen John Cage programmed on anything in my whole life.
Huh. Seriously?
Seriously.
Wow.
I mean, believe me, if there was a John Cage piece programmed and I saw an advertisement for it, I would be there.
Right. I feel like surely I've been to a performance where he has been performed and played. I have to say I don't think I've been to a concert where 4 minutes and 33 seconds was performed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that piece, I can understand why people would feel uncomfortable with that. People are uncomfortable with silence, you know?
Yeah.
But with all the other wacky things that are getting attention, it seems really odd that people wouldn't program him. Maybe it's because he's now considered an old fogey.
Well,
you know?
Fogey, but also his music's really damn hard.
Yeah.
Really hard. I mean, sonatas and interludes is not, like, and that's something, like, well, you just have to, like, you know, tear a piano up to do it, though, which might be part of why that doesn't get performed often.
Right.
But music of changes, you have to be a virtuoso to pull that off.
Huh. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. So we were when
but
you
still,
asked me this
I
question,
mean,
like, oh,
if you hear Fernyhough, you know, Brian Fernyhough, people play his stuff, and that's like crazy stuff. That's virtuosic.
I wonder what it is.
Maybe people feel like, yeah, like he's so insider now that people don't want to do him. You know,
it's a possibility.
Perform his stuff. Oh. You know, I'd rather do something that's, like, even wilder.
Mm. Like, the new music people want to do new music, and then the old music people want to do old music, and then there's like, no room in between.
You just can't win, yeah.
So when we were talking about outsiders becoming insiders, I thought of two, like, composers that were contemporary to each other working... one in the United States, Aaron Copland, and the other in Soviet Russia, Dmitri Shostakovich. And I think it's really interesting to look at sort of their two trajectories as composers, because both of them actually started out being quite experimental. Copland's early works were really his first piano concerto received some very critical reception about it being too noisy sound. I think there was one quote where somebody said it sounded like cows because he incorporated, like, it, you know, to us today it doesn't sound like that, but he incorporated some jazz elements
right.
That was really risque at the time. And Copland really, you know, I think he kind of took it personally, and he took a little bit of a break from composing for a while and then came back with this sort of very simplified sound that we recognize as the Copland sound today, the parallel fourths and fifths, the open harmonies, brass heavy parallel motion that developed a whole kind of tonal language of classical Americana that's, you know, ubiquitous in everything from Copland's music to movie scores for cowboy movies. Versus, like, Shostakovich, who was kind of this enfant terrible of the Soviet scene in the 19-teens and 20s. And he had, like, he was doing, like, all these, like, really, you know, modernist works that were still catchy and a little bit edgy.
Right.
And Then he writes Lady Macbeth of Minsk District. And it's like a huge hit. People are eating it up, even though it's like
a very
gritty drama, operatic drama. Until 2 years after, I think it premieres, Stalin sees it. And Stalin puts the lid on it. He tells the Pravda denounce Shostakovich. Shostakovich is scared for his life. He's afraid, the Stasi are going to kidnap him.
Yeah.
That really makes Shostakovich reassess his approach, and he returns with the Fifth Symphony as a response to just criticism, is the famous quote the symphony was. And it's a return to like a very more accessible tonal language that still has elements of modernism, but they're not full-blown to the way Lady Macbeth or, say, The Nose is. And I think
he definitely, he learned how to work within the system.
Yeah.
But also be somewhat true to his own desires and composition. Yeah.
Yeah, and both very fine line. And Shostakovich now are, you know, held up as models of their respective nation's musical output in the 20th century.
Right.
So we can see this underlying tension that we talked a little bit about premier earlier, about an outsider having to walk the line or toe the line of an insider in order to create art, and in order, like in Shostakovich's case, just to literally survive.
Just to live, yeah.
Yeah. So it's an interesting thing to think about.
Right. So let's see here. Where are we on? And then what can also point to a composer being an outsider is the reasons why they are doing their thing. Mm-hmm. In the case of the avant-gardists, it's a conscious break with the past. So I did a little bit of research on Yoko Ono, and I definitely think of her when I think of outsider.
Yeah, well, she's definitely on the avant-garde. She's at, you know, the head of the avant-gardists. And has been for about 50 years now or something.
I mean, she's still, she has never been an insider. So Yoko Ono was born in 1933 into a wealthy Japanese banking family whose fortune was later lost during World War II. They ended up living in the Japanese countryside during the war and just suffered from severe hunger. Her family moved back and forth between the U.S. and Japan. In the 50s, her family moved to New York. She had stayed in Japan to go to school, but then in 1953, she left school and decided to move to New York City. She enrolled at Sarah Lawrence College, but didn't finish it, and instead she begins to become involved in the New York City avant-garde art scene. One piece from her period from 1953 is called Secret Piece, and it's simply instructions, and it is this: decide on one note that you want to play. Play it with the following accompaniment: the woods from 5 a.m. to 8 a.m. in summer. And that's it. So obviously that's very much influenced by Cage and almost performance art. Her musical work is certainly, it blurs a line with performance art, I think. Okay. And in 1960, she's involved with the Fluxus Group, which involves John Cage and Lamont Young. Her pieces instructions can be completed anywhere by anyone. And they often have to do with the performers' identities becoming hidden. So, like in Bag Piece, two performers climb inside a large bag in which they can see out, but the audience cannot see in. And so the performers are become detached from their sex and their race, age, any kind of identifier, and they're only bodies like moving inside this bag. Yeah, it's very interesting. Probably her seminal piece, one of her most important one, is Cut Piece, which was premiered in 1964. And she called these...
You can see Cut Piece, by the way. It's on YouTube.
Oh, okay. That's like her performing it?
Yeah.
Yeah, she's performed it a few times, not just, you know, once or twice. And she called these, quote, striptease shows, which is an interesting... Like, I was kind of surprised that she would call it that because of the philosophy behind it. So what it is
well, I think it's like it's commenting on voyeurism,
right?
If you watch the piece, the one I've seen is like she's very young. It must have been the premiere, and for the most part she has a very you know, just keeping her face very straight, unemotional. But there's certain moments where, like, you know, yeah, giggly men are cutting bits off of her dress or top, and it does look like she's about to break down and cry.
Right, but, like, I guess her calling them that seems flippant to me. And that's what kind of, like, jolts me, is because it's so not. It's a very serious piece of art. Yeah. And so what it is to people who don't know it, she, kneels down on the stage. Her legs are folded underneath her. And she invites the audience to come up and cut off her clothing in pieces. And they get to keep the pieces of her clothing. And she is silent throughout. And the piece ends at her... at the performer's option. I think in her London performance, in her London premiere, she did actually she just ended up being completely naked at the end. And so it's the prototype for feminist performance art. It confronts, like we said, voyeurism, sexual aggression, gender subordination, and violence against women. And you're right, like, yeah, there are people, like, giggling because they don't, like, they're uncomfortable, and...
They're uncomfortable, but they're still participating in it.
Right, like, they're being forced to participate, and it feels wrong, but there's a lot of complicated feelings, and, yeah, I think it's a really cool piece. One reaction to her Tokyo performance, which was billed as a music concert, by the way, and one audience member said, quote, "Since there wasn't any music, I want my money back," end quote. So it's her works make people uncomfortable, and that's still the case today.
I think, like, making audiences uncomfortable being difficult is something that qualifies her as an outsider and as an avant-gardist.
Right. Definitely. She's pushing the limits of what you can call art and music, and as well as our own personal limits of what we want to accept. Do we want to accept her definition of that art? Right, and so there is some irony, and you mentioned this in the notes, Pinky, that, so everyone knows who she is because she married one of the most popular people on the planet, John Lennon. And so she was, like, thrust into this insider club. But she was immediately reviled, right?
Yeah.
And she
was it, is that like because she's an outsider, because she's a woman, because she was seen as breaking up the band, as like an interloper, you know, disrupting the homosociality of Paul and John's relationship. It's, it's pretty messed up when you think about it nowadays.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, she, I don't think anything she could do would endear her to people, you know.
It's kind of like she's Hillary of the music world.
Of rock and roll. Uh-huh. And maybe that is what we also, as outsiders, we identify with. We are attracted to that in her.
Yeah, it's sort of like, I mean, it goes out, when you think about it, outsider status and coolness go hand in hand.
Totally, yeah.
It's cool to be a rebel without a cause.
Unless you're in high school or middle
school. You're in high school in Oklahoma, and then you just get your ass kicked. But it's still, yeah, it's cool. And those people, those artists that are outsiders and succeed in some way while being an outsider, or at least maintaining that image of being an outsider, are, I think, sort of what give a lot of us other outsiders hope.
Right. We like to see somebody stick it to the man every once in a while.
Well, that's why Bernie Sanders was so popular in 2016, why Donald Trump is so popular at the time of this recording.
Right.
It's the allure of the outsider.
Right. Totally. We've run out of time, but some other outsiders that, if you're interested in looking at specifically in classical music, are one is Carlos, or is it Carlos? Yeah, Carlos Gesualdo.
The S is silent.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. In Italian, though, you say the S, but maybe not back then.
Maybe not. I've always heard it Carlo, but I don't know.
Well, okay, so Carlos Gesualdo was
Can you spell his last name?
I will spell his last name. Gesualdo. Gesualdo was the Prince of Venosa in the late 16th and early 17th centuries. Another really interesting guy. You're going to find a lot of information about him murdering his wife and her lover, but that is not what totally makes him an outsider, although it does make him an interesting bad person. His music was rather different at the time, harmonically, so you can check him out. And we also recommend looking into someone more contemporary, and that is Terry Riley, who is still alive today.
Today's his birthday, actually.
It's
his 81st birthday. June
24th. Well, happy birthday, Terry Riley.
He looks like Dumbledore, too, so.
Yeah. That's what happens when we move out to California.
Terry Riley was one of the first composers to really develop the musical idiom that we call minimalism. You might be familiar with other minimalist composers like Philip Glass. But Terry Riley really is one of those guys who's marched to the beat of his own drum. Despite the incredible popularity some of his music has had and influence.
Right.
So I think he's worth checking out.
Yeah. And, of course, we would love to thank the San Francisco Conservatory of Music for allowing us to record at their conservatory, as well as for some money to make this happen.